How you guys doing? Hope you're in a good place. I hope you're in a good headspace. This is Giants Amongst Us, where we share in the unique human experience. And where you're going to hear real stories told by real people, people just like yourself. If this is your first time tuning in, understand that these stories are tales of redemption. These are stories of accountability, responsibility. These are testimonies and examples of what the human spirit is capable of. Changes that can be made once someone applies themselves. And they're meant to be examples. They're meant to be beacons of hope to anybody who's feeling hopeless, to anybody in a rut, to anybody feeling as if life is meaningless. Change can be made. We take heed to these unheard cries for meaning. Word to Viktor Frankl. I'd like you to let these stories play. I'd like you to let these stories remind you that you are in fact worth the effort, that your life has meaning, and that change can be had. So with that being said, pull up a chair, kick your feet up, do whatever it is you do as you let this play in the background and go about your day. I have another conversation that I'd like to share with you all. I have another story that I'd like to introduce to you all. From being raised off-grid with two loving parents to losing his mother early on, Peter joins us today, and he's got a story to tell. Like he said during our talk, as a youngin, there was a whole lot of debauchery, crashing out and flipping cars over. And at 18 years old, he was given $30,000 as an inheritance from a family member. Then there was the heroin addiction, and on the streets with only $7 to his name. County jail, shelters, rehab. Peter's felt the highs and he knows the lows. But these days, he's got a plan and his sights set on hitting six figures. With a new mindset, attitude, plus he's sober. Let's hear how he did it. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, this is Peter and his story. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back with another one. This is Giants Amongst Us, where we share in that unique human experience. And today I have Peter, and he took time out of his day to sit down and have a conversation with us. So appreciate it, man. Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, no problem. I appreciate you. And I'm glad you could pull me on here to have a little chat.
Yeah, man. You know, let's just jump it off from starters. And can you share with us, you know, where you come from and how it was for you growing up?
Absolutely. I think it's we should probably start with just really quick the how my parents came to meet and move up to the area that I was born in. So my mother was born in the Azores Islands, right off it's far off the coast of Portugal, the middle of the Pacific. And she was one of 17 children, which is crazy. Yeah. One of 17 kids, and she was adopted by a well-off doctor, her and all of the children, right? The parents, it's an impoverished area. One of my grandfather was kicked in the head by a horse and couldn't take care of all the kids. So all the kids got adopted by a well-off family in New York and raised there. And then my mom met my dad in Brentwood, New York, and moved to North Idaho in the late 80s. And started having kids, my sister in 94, and then me in 97, my brother in 2000, and started a family there. So I grew up off-grid, solar powerhouse. My dad would haul water and pump it up this huge hill, and it was like a gravity feed to the house. And he's a carpenter, so he built the house. Real cool setup, you know. But
yeah.
nobody was super well off financially. You know, we had everything we needed, but there was no extra, really, you know.
Did you guys have livestock too?
No livestock. Nope. They weren't much in the way of farmers. You know, he was still a city boy at heart, that they were just living in the country, you know. So, yeah, I have good memories of that. And it's interesting because I grew up with like a rotary phone, right? And my parents had a 16mm projector that we would watch like Bugs Bunny from the 50s on, you know. But this is to be fair, this is the early 2000s. This is like 2002, 3, 4, 5, you know, as I'm growing up. And we're, you know, and so we have the technology of like, you know, the 70s, maybe 80s, VHS tapes, you know. It was an interesting, but it was a good upbringing, man. I wouldn't trade it for the world. We were going outside, we were playing, we were riding bikes, we were building mini bikes, you know, get a lawnmower out of the trash and get the engine off of it and put a centrifugal clutch on it and put it on this frame and make a little motorcycle, you know?
Mm-hmm. Were these things that you picked up watching your father, or these are things you just trial and error, you know, you picked up as you went?
Oh, this is definitely my dad. My dad was showing us all this stuff. You know, he's a mechanically minded guy and a contractor. Thing. He was running a contracting business at that point, building houses. So my little brother paid a lot more attention to the fixing of the vehicles, and he's a damn good mechanic now. And I can wrench, but I'm more of a, you know, I followed more of his contracting experience, you know, where it's, I've built some houses in the past and such things like that. So I went a little bit more that route, but
that's right.
Anywho, that's basically the upbringing is, you know, not a lot of money, but enough and loving parents. Right. And then in 2005, 2006, my mom got diagnosed with breast cancer, and it was fairly advanced, and she had a mastectomy, but the tumors came back. So she got radiation, chemotherapy, trying to get that under control, and she ended up getting radiation-induced leukemia in that. So that kind of sent that downhill to the point where she passed in 2008. And I never really dealt very good with that loss, you know? We didn't grieve as a family much. We mostly just didn't talk about it. And that's really not the right way to handle loss, and I got to experience why that is, you know? And I wouldn't blame some of my wrongdoings on that in any way, but I'd say that it was maybe a factor a little bit, you know, of repressed feelings as a young teen.
Yeah.
You know? Because that's when I started really acting out as a kid, you know?
How old were you exactly when your mother passed away?
Oh, I was 12. Yep.
Wow, man.
I was 12, 12 and a half. Right in sixth grade, right? So she died on a Saturday. I was in school on a Monday type thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it messed with me a little bit. And for some reason, maybe that and some other reasons, but I started acting out. I ended up smoking a lot of weed at that time. You know, all my friends were stoners and I thought it was real cool. So smoking a lot of weed and hanging out with people who were, you know, we're all easily impressionable at that age. And we ended up stealing a couple cars at 14, you know, that year and a half culminated in a couple joyriding incidents, stealing cars, go, you know, race them around and smash them into things and then burn them was the goal, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be some charges, right? We got caught because we were telling all our friends, hey, look how cool we are. We stole a bunch of cars. And it's a
word
small
gets
town.
Around.
Oh, man. It was a town of 3,000 people. So,
oh, man. Okay. Yeah. Everybody knows everybody.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep. So we got in trouble and I had to go to juvie for, gosh, maybe a month or so and pay a bunch of restitution that I think my parents ended up paying because I don't remember getting a job and working for. I think my parents just paid the restitution for me because I don't remember paying it, honestly. But that was the beginning of problems, right? That was pretty much the rest of high school was drinking a little too much, smoking a bunch of weed, and generally being an asshole. I thought I was Ken Block. I've wrecked so many cars just because I want to drift them around and stuff. And so gosh, man, my dad had built it was a 1980 Mercedes-Benz 240D with a 289 out of a Ford Falcon that he had placed in there. And with a 700 R4 or a, I forget what tranny he had in it. No, it wasn't. It was a turbo 400 maybe. Anyway, I flipped that thing on its roof, man, destroyed it. Yeah, really
out of
sad.
All these wreckages, did you ever end up in a hospital?
Oh, only for minor things. Nope. I flipped that thing over with five people in it. And two of my buddies landed on their feet because they weren't wearing no seatbelt. You know,
like
they
a just cat.
Spun. Yeah, like a cat. Yeah. Yeah. They spun and landed on their feet. And I always remember just being amazed. We flipped that thing back over by hand just because we had five of us. We were all pretty strong. Rolled it back over. Drove it back to school, just all smashed up and smoking. Yeah. Not good. I put
everybody walked away from it.
Oh yeah. Yep. We all walked away. Yeah. No one ever got real hurt. We put a Subaru into a swamp. I smashed a car into the back of my school in my junior year. You know, those big, great, concrete barristers.
Yeah.
I smacked a car sideways into one of them right behind the school. I got in trouble for that one.
Was it just you in the car? You had some friends with you?
No, we were five deep again. It was always when there's a bunch of people there, you're trying to show off, you know?
Yeah, right. doing the most.
Oh gosh. So that was high school. It's just a carnage of vehicles. And, you know, I've always been an intellectual guy. I've been fairly intelligent, you know? So I would look at the class rubric and see, look, man, it's 80% tests and quizzes. It's 20% like day work, you know? So I would never do anything in those classes. I would just screw off and bug people and throw things around the room and just be a dick. And then when it comes time to do the test, I would just do the test because all the tests are easy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I would get like a B on it. And so I passed the class with a C and I never did anything. It wasn't good, man. I was a little out of control, and that just kept going after I graduated, right? What was it? It was my graduation day. I was super high on Subutex, which is it's like a way that people get off of heroin. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
Well, say that again. What is it?
It's called Subutex.
It's like when they're when somebody's weaning off of heroin, that's what they put them on.
Yeah. Yep. 54-411s. So they're like big white, or they were big white round pills, and they're really strong, man. Honestly, it's it's maybe good if you're coming off of heroin, but for an average school child, this is not a good thing to snort or to eat. And so I remember using that for graduation and just being blasted out on that. And that was kind of the beginning of the end. I made more friends that were into harder drugs and started spending time with those people. And then that's when stuff really started going downhill for me.
When you were riding around and just crashing, burning everywhere, was your father ever, you know, did he ever get wind of it, or did he know what was going on, or a lot of that stuff was just going outside of, you know, the scope of him able to, you know, have a good idea of what's really going on with you and your extracurricular activities?
Well, he definitely knew. And I think that he did his best to try to steer me back towards, you know, being a normal person. I remember one day when I put the Subaru in.
Trying to get you lying a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I remember when I put the Subaru in the swamp and we had pulled it out with another truck and just destroyed the side of it, raking up on a tree. We had it trailered back to the house, and he was mad. He's like, well, if you're going to beat this car that I gave to you, I'm going to beat it too. I paid for it, you know? And so he gets behind the wheel and just starts rallying this little car around the house, jumping it down this embankment, like just going crazy with it. Well, you know, I'll never forget it. It was a funny experience, you know? Yeah. And I tried to hide some stuff. Like I had taken the rear brake calipers, it was a four-wheel disc brake on the Benz that I had flipped. Before I flipped it, I had taken the rear brake calipers off and hung them with baling wire from the strut towers so that I could power brake the car. Like, I'd push the brakes and only the front brakes would go. So then I could stomp the gas and do big burnouts, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I had to change it back before he noticed. So early one morning, I got up and got out there and started fucking around with it. And then when he got up, I was like, oh, man, I was just trying to check my brakes. And, you know, I messed up. You give me a hand and had him help me put them back together. You know, so I was sneaky, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, because that's a whole lot of action, you know, to go unnoticed, especially if you're, like you said, in a town where everybody knows everybody. Word gets around quick.
Oh, man, it really does. And so that was that part there. And then after I graduated, what happened? Oh, yeah. So the rich family, right, that adopted my mother, that was my uncle. We called him Uncle George.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle George. And I don't know why we call him uncle, but that's just what we called him. And he left college fund money to all of the kids, right? Like all his grandchildren, quote unquote, because mm-hmm. the dude was loaded. So there's a lot of kids, but every kid got like 30 grand in a 529 plan. And wow. Yeah, when I turned 18, they just gave me the keys to that. And they were like, here's 30 grand, go to college. And I was like, well, all right, bet. Wow. I'm going to go rent a house and go buy some dope and get a new motorcycle and go cause hell, you know, go raise hell.
30 so grand, that, 18 years yeah, old, yeah. And bam, here you are. You got 30 grand. Have at it.
Yep. And so that was it.
Living a life.
Well, for a little bit, you right. know, it goes by fast. But for a kid, you know, that has, especially that came from, you know, close to poverty line, 30 G's was a lot of money, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so that's what that went to. It was, I moved to Moscow, Idaho, which is a college town. And and we rented a little spot. All I remember is getting real drunk. I think me and a buddy killed like a box of wine and some whiskey or so. I remember stealing someone's American flag from their like their front porch because it had fell over, and I was like, unpatriotic to leave it on the ground. And so yeah. I remember just taking it and carrying it around, and it was huge, like 10 feet tall, big ass flagpole, walking down the streets of Moscow, just hammered drunk. Yeah, there was a lot of debauchery that went on, and I was kind of enabled with that money, you know?
Yeah, especially if it's not, you know, coming from where you're coming from, you know, it's like one thing, say, if you work for it and then you earn it, but just to have 30 grand dropped on your lap and here you go, you know, this is what you need to do with it. But when it comes in that shape and that form and in a way handed to you, that's a recipe for disaster.
It absolutely was. It absolutely was. And that's really where it starts to get more ugly, is that I had a good buddy, right? Is my buddy Davis, and me and him were tight, and his sister was a bit wild, and she had an ex-boyfriend that she was running around with, and he had gone to prison, and he was just getting out of prison. And I happened to be hanging out with Davis when the ex-boyfriend gets back out of prison, and he was the type of dude that just hustled, you know what I mean? He was like one of those guys that didn't really want to get a job, and so he started selling heroin to make money, you know? And I'll never forget going over to there. They had like a little mobile home out in the sticks, kind of in a rural area. And we went over there just to hang out with Andrea, the sister, you know? And I remember that dude came out and he's like, hey, you guys got to try this, you know? Cause we'd smoke weed and stuff we were doing a bunch of dabs. That's when dabs were cool, you know? And he's like, you guys got to try this. And he had some heroin on tinfoil. And he's like, here, this is free. Like, try it out, you know? Cause looking back, I realized why it was free for a day or two is because how do you, you know, you get clients for your heroin right, business,
yeah.
Get some people hooked, right? And yeah. That's what it was, dude. And so we smoked that, and it kind of just made you feel real weird. And then he had a bunch of meth, and he's like, here, try this, pass the meth pipe around. And I don't know if you've ever done meth, but the first time you do it, it's like, it's crazy. It just makes you feel elated. No, you feel like you're on top of the world, yeah. You know?
Superman, yeah. He-Man, you put the cape on. Now no one, No one can. Yeah, like you said, exactly. It feels like you're on top of the world, and there's really nobody that can step on your show or tell you this or tell you that. You know, your confidence is sky high.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember doing push-ups and playing Mortal Kombat. That was what it was. It was just banging push-ups out. Just bam, 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 bam.
And then, fun.
yep. Banging out push-ups and playing Mortal Kombat. And that was the beginning of a problem, a big problem in my life, because that stuff's expensive. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the deal, is that I quickly realized that I like this and I need to do it more, I guess, you know, and I quickly got hooked, especially on the heroin for some reason. And the meth is cool. And I would use meth to wake myself back up. Or, if I didn't have heroin and I was coming down, I would smoke meth until I could get some more heroin, basically. But I used meth as more of a crutch, and the heroin was more of my addiction. Even though when I was high, I was useless. Like, I just wanted to sleep, which is so counterintuitive, really.
Right.
It don't make any sense, but that was the truth of it, is that it's just the addictive property of the drug, and less, you know, the symptoms of what the drug does for you. It's more, you know, just your addiction to it. It gets horrible. That's what started, is I started selling dope because I could get it from him for a lesser price than I could sell it for up in my hometown. So we rented a house up in Bonner's Ferry, Idaho, and I started selling dope. I started buying, like, well, with heroin, you don't measure in ounces, you measure in pieces. And so a piece is 24 grams instead of 28 to an ounce. Uh-huh. And so I would buy half pieces, which were 12 ounces, and bring it up to Bonner's, and I'd cut it with instant coffee and vinegar.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is crazy. But that's what I did. Yeah. Was Folgers instant coffee and white vinegar. And to this day, the smell of instant coffee or vinegar
reminds you of that.
Oh, dude, it sends me back. Yep. But I would chop it up and break it down like 20% maybe.
Did you get that from anybody, that cutting tip, or you just figured out, you know what, let me try to see if this works. I think it might be a good mix and match.
No, that's what homeboy did. That's what the dude that was selling it to me
right.
did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I would get it pure from him and then just aggressively cut it. And for some reason, people liked it. Mostly it was smokers, though. I think people did shoot it up and didn't complain too much. But that just goes to show what you're actually putting in your body, man. You have no idea.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's horrible. Horrible. Man. But yeah, that was my lick, was I would get it and bring it up and then sell it for $30 a point. Yep. Oh, stomp on it. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then sell it for top dollar, $300 a gram, which is ridiculous. And, but I was the only act in town.
Okay. So supply and demand, that was all you.
Yeah. Yep. I would have made a lot of money, but I had a horrible habit and it was out of control. And so I really didn't make any money, and I barely paid for the habit, you know?
When you were at your, I wouldn't say lowest, but I guess your most active usage of the heroin, how much you think you were using a day?
At the worst point, I was probably smoking like maybe a gram a day, but that didn't last that long. Most, you know, between a half gram and a gram a day, something like that.
How about at that time, how much of your 30 grand did you have? Was that pretty much blown?
No, I had probably, you know, maybe 30% left, something like that.
Oh, you were partying hard, huh?
Yeah, enough that I was trying to make it last longer by selling and trying to make something happen with it. It was disappearing fast, you know? And at that point, I got robbed by some kids who knew what I had going on and got me at the right time. I had gone to jail. I got picked up on a some warrant for something and spent a little bit of time in jail. And when I got out, the house had got door kicked in. You know, people had taken what they wanted.
Damn.
That set me back. It was kind of the end of my selling career there. It really was, because I moved there soon after that and went back down to Coeur d'Alene, which is a larger metropolitan area south of us, you know, and bounced around through a few different houses with a girlfriend at the time that I had some friends who needed a roommate, whatever. And I did that for a bit. I ended up robbing the person that owned the house. And that's what's crazy, is that when you start using drugs and now you don't have money and but you need to fulfill your habit, it's almost like your brain tells you that you have to have it. Like, you're going to die if you don't get the drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it ended up being, was that by any means I was going to get dope. And that's what it turned into, is that I just started selling shit in the house. Like, I just grabbed this chick's PS4 back in the day when a PS4 was nice, and go pawn it. And then I pawned like all of her like weed eaters and chainsaws and surround sound. I just unhooked the surround sound from the fucking living room and went and pawned everything. It for dope. Everything. it's crazy. Uh-huh.
Were you going to the same pawn shop? Because I know sometimes they get your information. You know, they take, I don't know how it is over there, but they'll take a photo of you. Then when you start coming once or twice, you're like, what's really going on over here?
Yeah. I went to the same one, and I did get caught for a hoverboard that I had pawned or something.
The hoverboard?
Yeah.
Is there such a thing?
Well, they call them hoverboards. They're like... what are those? They're wheels with a gyroscope that you like a one wheel, you know?
Right on. You know,
Yeah, they call them hoverboards. But yeah, I got caught, but it was my girlfriend's friend, and she must have talked her into not pressing charges. You know what I mean?
Sometimes, you know, there are people that they know the ones to go to. Like, they'd rather get it for cheap. They're going to get whatever they need to get off of you for pennies on the dollar. And, you know, other ones, they kind of enforce the rules a little bit, and they start asking information, and they're seeing you one day out the week, then 2 days out the week, and 3 days. It starts to raise some red flags. What's going on over here?
Yeah. But that's basically it, is that I was just robbing people blind, unfortunately. And that pull towards the drug is so heavy. Like, I had a good buddy, right? And he was my girlfriend's brother, right? And we lived with him too. He lived in the house too. And one day we got some real good dope, and he slammed it. I never really used needles. I would smoke the shit, but he slammed it like with a needle. And one day I go in his room, and the dude is crunched over on his bed, and his face is real blue and like purple looking. And I shook him to see if he's okay, and he just falls on the ground. And so I start freaking out, and I call my girl. I'm like, Cheyenne, get in here. And she came in, and sure enough, I mean, this dude he's dying in front of us, you know, and his face was going literally blue, like the color of a blue shirt or something. Like, it's when you see it, you know, he's a white boy and his face was blue, like he's getting no oxygen. And she is a bigger girl. She's pretty tough. And she got on top of him and started giving him CPR and just pumping his chest, you know. And to give you an idea of where your mind is when you're a drug addict, I stepped over the dude and grabbed his dope off the counter while he's dying on the floor. And my girl's trying to save her brother's life, right? Step over him, grab that dope, stick it in your pocket. And then I called 911. Like, that gives you an idea of the pull of that. And the cop showed up, the fire department, they Narcan'd him quick, you know, stick him with the needle like an EpiPen. And brought the dude back, but just barely. You know, they said if she hadn't have been pumping on him like that, he would have been brain dead.
She was still able to give oxygen to his get oxygen to his brain during that time then, huh?
Yeah, it's like artificially pumping the heart with your hands.
Right.
Right, with that force that makes the blood go through the brain and bring oxygenated blood to the brain.
Just enough.
That will keep you alive, yeah. Yeah. So very close to death. And that's one of two overdoses that I've been a part of, really. If you fast forward a year or so, you know, same stuff happening in that year, just general debauchery. A girl had overdosed in this little mobile home behind my behind Cheyenne's house, behind the same girlfriend. And she was going blue. They were trying to stuff a dope pipe in her mouth and light it and tell her to suck on it. But she was out. Like, I remember a big dude was holding her from behind and I was slapping her in the face like hard. Like, I never hit a woman in my life except that time. Mm-hmm. And I was smacking this girl like hard as I could, you know, and it wasn't doing anything, you know, it was just beating her up for no reason, but we were trying, you know, and somebody ended up coming out with probably an 80 shot of meth, right? Like a fat shot of meth, and found a vein and fucking blasted her with it. And you've never seen someone wake up so fast. That saved her life, as crazy as it is. She was dying right in this dude's arms, and this shot of dope and her eyes just fly open. And I mean, she was real fucked up for about a day, but she lived, you know.
Was she slamming it or did she smoke it when that happened?
She had someone make a shot up for her of heroin. But it was probably only like a point, right? So like 0.1 of a gram.
Right.
But that was too much, you know. That was too much. And that's how quick it is.
And of all the years that you were using it, you never had any close calls like that with yourself in the high?
No. Smoking it it's a lot safer. Nowadays,
safer, right.
With fentanyl, though, you're still treading a line. And you can OD on fentanyl by smoking it. And there was fentanyl around when I was using, but I never liked it. And it's a little slightly different high than heroin. And it wasn't nearly as prevalent, you know, 7 or so years ago.
It seems like nowadays, I mean, I'm far away from the scene now. But I mean, it seems like nowadays, if you're using and you're, you know, because sometimes the connect isn't there and you're getting it through people you don't really know. So just as long as they have it, you're going to go ahead and you're going to get it from them. And it's a crap shot because it seems like nowadays, damn near everything has fentanyl in it.
Yeah, it's super sad, dude. And when I got out, it hadn't really fully hit yet. Thank goodness, you know, but no, I never was compelled to use a needle and always was just happy smoking it. But it still destroyed my life, you know, like the lowest point of that arc is probably when I lost my car. I lost, you know, the respect of my family.
Yeah,
I had burned every bridge that I possibly could burn. I had asked my aunties for money and didn't pay them back. My dad, my brother, you know, everyone in my every avenue of getting money was dried up for me, at least in my mind, you know, of easily getting loans and this and that. I had burnt through the college fund at this point for a while. And now I was homeless, right? I wasn't welcome at my parents' house and I wasn't welcome anywhere else because I was a thieving junkie, right?
Right.
That only cared about getting high and was really good for nothing. And no one wants you around when you're just going to rob them and then fall asleep on their couch, you know?
Like, yeah.
So I was homeless and I ended up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And it was gorgeous, dude. It was this time of year. It was this time of year, probably, I don't know, 2018, maybe 2017 or 2018, something like that. And it was gorgeous springtime. And I have $7 in my pocket and no drugs. And I'm coming down bad. And just
$7 to your name.
$7 to my name. Yep. I have a five and two ones in the back pocket. I'm smoking halfies out of ashtrays. And
at this time, you like you mentioned, this is when you're out in the streets, you have really nowhere to stay. So it's you yourself, $7 in your pocket.
Yep. Yep. Wow. I had a little tent that I strapped on my back with a sleeping bag.
A vagabond. And I would go,
yep. The handkerchief and the stick, man. Yep. I was
hoboing it, huh?
Oh, down bad. I had a bush that I would sleep in up on Tubbs Hill in Coeur d'Alene.
Yeah.
And it was my bush.
Right up until that point, how many years were you already using and living that life, you know, of just reckless abandonment?
That was the third year. It goes fast.
So you were going hard for 3 years.
Yeah. Well, the whole arc is 4 years. The third year, yep, is when I really got bad.
Crashed out. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And so that was my lowest point, man, is that no money for food. I would go to the homeless shelter and, And every day you'd have to go at like 5 o'clock in the morning and to like, to get a head count to see if you can get a bed, you know? But there was so many homeless that you probably weren't going to make it. You know what I mean? But every morning I would go and I would sit out there with these people that are just, you know, they're down bad. They're rough, homeless people, yeah. You know? And mm-hmm. I'd sit out there with them as a kid. I'm 21 years old and still look kind of fresh, you know, but a little clap back and trying to get shelter, you know what I mean? And like food. And gosh, it's a humbling experience. It really is. It really is. And I was able to pull myself out of that, but only by getting arrested, dude, was what it took.
Getting arrested. So when you were trying to get your bed and everything like that, were you going through, how was your body reacting to it all? Were you getting dope sick? Were you fighting it? Was it more mental? Was it physical? What were you dealing with?
Oh, I was definitely dope sick. I was still using drugs, but only when I could find them, you know, like, I had a buddy who was working part-time on a construction site and noticed there was some, you know, there's some things of value there. So at night we went and, grabbed these paddle boards and held them on top of his car as we drove away and sold them on Craigslist, just ballsy, you know, and got a couple bucks to go get some dope. Like, so it was a hit and miss lifestyle there.
Where you were going through some dry spouts then and hurting when you were.
Oh yeah. And it's, and coming down off of heroin is not, it's not a fun time, man.
How does that, can you kind of like a little overview of what you're going through when you are dope sick? Cause you hear, you know, I mean, I've never done heroin. I've done a lot of other things, but I've never did heroin. So I've never had to deal with that. But I hear it's hell. And how do you feel about, as far as addiction, do you see it as a learned behavior, or do you see it as a, like what a lot of people call it now, and some people refer to it as a disease?
Well, to answer the first part, I feel like it basically it's you start to feel real off, very uncomfortable at first when you're coming down, and then I notice myself sweating more, and I get real irritable. And then you get what's called restless leg syndrome, which is, or at least I did, which is where the leg muscles are constantly firing, like they're twitching, and they hurt badly. And there's nothing you can do to make them not ache. And you can try to, you know, work out, or, but you wouldn't work out because you're a heroin addict, but you could try to do some stretches or like, you know, move them around, but your legs just, it feels like you want to cut them off is how it feels. I can't quite explain it better than that, but you, and then you just feel, I would get cold shakes and shivers, but I'm sweating kind of like a fever, and that would persist 4 days on end. But you wouldn't let yourself ever really get to that point. You would go rob someone or do something, man, to get dope. Like one way or the other,
you would do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what the mind tells you, is that this is unacceptable and you have to get drugs right now. There's no other, you know? And, so that's what you do. You'd go do horrible things to get dope. I only had like a very short list of things that I wouldn't do, and you could imagine what they were, and every other thing was on the table, you know?
Right. Yeah. And then you have some people that really, they go to that extreme where I think you're talking about, you know, just to get away from what the body is going to go through to sit and go through that hell.
But
you got to sit through that and deal with that.
Yeah. Yep. And that's what it was, is that I was done with the way my life was, and I had to.
So you got arrested.
You know, yeah. But leading up to being arrested, I was exhausted, you know, of the situation, and I couldn't quite stand what I had become, you know.
Reflecting.
Yeah, but I kept using drugs, and I finally got arrested for smashing a guy's windows out. It was over a girl. She liked to see guys fight, you know what I mean, and wanted to cause problems. And so, long story short, I busted this dude's windows out and got a felony charge for it and a warrant. And so they picked me up in Spokane County for this this felony, and I did a big rotation of county jails, Spokane County, Newport, Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, Sandpoint, all the way up to Bonners Ferry to face charges. And I ended up spending about 4 months in county jail. Mm-hmm. And that's where I finally began to, you know, understand that I had a massive problem, because I sobered up in jail and it sucked, but it was necessary, you know? Yeah. And I started to see that I had a major problem and I need to get my crap together, you know? And so that was really a blessing, was to get locked up. And I got in decent shape. I was, you know, doing exercises with the guys in jail and doing the prison workout, whatever type thing.
Yeah, and burpees and everything, huh?
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, and I got out and I thought I was like, all right, you know what? I got this. I just won't do heroin no more. I'll just drink and smoke weed, you know? And that lasted for a few months. Then I got another girlfriend that wanted to, you know, smoke heroin and do drugs. Yeah. And I ended up using with her and then split off because she was nuts, you know? And that was finally the time. It was July 1st, 2019 was the day that I said, you know what? I'm done with everything and I can't drink. I can't smoke weed. I can't do drugs. I'm done.
Like you had mentioned, you were already fed up with it and you kind of picked up the fling for a little bit. But once this girl was out of your life again, it was back to where you were sitting. It seems like you were already at that crossroad and feeling like, you know, there's no future in this. You know, look what I've become. And it's about time to just start making some changes in an effort to take this in a different direction.
Absolutely, yeah. Dude. I mean, you would look around you and you'd see, I mean, I remember clearly watching a guy try to fix a box fan while it's still running, you know, and he's like hitting his fingers on the fan and ow. It's like, yeah. You know, that's what you're dealing with. These people are, I remember tuning chainsaws inside an apartment complex at 3 o'clock in the morning. And you ever tuned a chainsaw, you got to hold it full, wide open throttle. And then you play with it. You play with the carburetor, get it to really scream, and then you bring it down just a touch. And we were doing that in the apartment complex in the middle of the night, like crazy things, you know? So yeah. I had to get away from that and be a normal person, you know, because
yeah. Like, so it was a combination insane. Of all of that, or was it like your self-worth? It was reflecting on all the relationships you burn, all the people you did wrong, and then just a wasted life. Was it a combination of everything that kind of set you, you know, on a different path and wanting to clean up?
Oh yeah. My self-worth for sure. And just looking around me and seeing the sort of person that I was surrounding myself with,
right,
and where they were in life. And then I got real serious about what I want out of life and saw that those two things were the direct antithesis of each other. You know, the fact that I need to change that, or this is where I'm headed. I'm going to be, you know, this guy who's an absolute loser. You know, I got to change. And so that's what I ended up doing. So I jumped into the rooms of AA and NA, and I can't say that I agree with every part of the program. I don't agree with all of it, but there are parts that I do. And really, the people in the program helped me to be accountable, right? And show me the way to do it. And whether or not I love every idea that they have, it doesn't matter. What matters is that we have something in common and we're here to not use drugs and not drink. And I can get behind that, you know? And so I mm-hmm. do my program different than other people. I never work the steps. I don't believe I'm powerless. There's plenty of things I don't agree with, but I do agree that at that point in time I had a problem and I need to be cognizant of that and be able to, you know, overcome these issues and to go on and not be an asshole and a drug addict, you know? And I think, so it's super helpful, man. AA and NA was a big part of me achieving sobriety and continuing sobriety.
I like that you said that I don't believe that I'm powerless, because a lot of people, when you start telling them that it's a disease, I don't know where you stand on that, but when you start telling them it's a disease and that once an addict, always an addict, I mean, you're already taking the power from them. Like, but you, if you put yourself in that situation and you created that lifestyle, then you also have the power to get yourself out of it.
That's absolutely right, man. That's really is the thing. Is that, well, a wise old guy once told me, what did he say? He said, every thought is a prayer and every word is a spell. And that's a true thing. And when you start talking about yourself negatively like that, it doesn't do no good at all. It doesn't do any good. It depends on your ideas of theology and your specific beliefs, maybe. But if you think about it like this, AA and NA work in almost, 165 different countries. And you couldn't you imagine the amount of different theologies, monotheism, polytheism, in all these different places, yet somehow the program still works for thousands and thousands upon thousands of people. And how is that possible? Well, it's the power of faith. The power of belief is massively powerful.
Yeah.
And, you know?
Man, you said it. And then there's also the whole study behind the placebo effect too. And then that also is like you're putting faith and trust in something. And now if you're putting that faith and trust in yourself and that you can start rewiring your brain and start creating different experiences by the way that you think, by the way that you act, by the way that you behave. And now you're the one in control. You're the one in power. And then you know, you're taking the wheel back and then now you're steering it in a better direction. And I like that you said that even though you didn't agree with everything, you were still taking from it what you felt was applicable in your life. And that was the, you know, the camaraderie or the network that you have in the community of people that were still trying to do things in a sober way. And, you know, you had that in common and that's where you were able to build from. It's not that you have to believe in everything wholeheartedly, but you were taking what you felt would be useful for you and it worked.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's a constantly evolving thing is my belief systems, you know, and I try to keep that way for a reason. It seems like something that I'll develop over even, you know, decades in the future as well. Like, so basically, that's how I conceive it of it at this point, is that if there is a higher power, and I imagine there would be, it's part of me, you know, and I'm capable of great things, good things and horrible and evil things. You know, I like to think that I'm, you know, all of those things together, and it depends on what I decide to do with it. You know, I think I have more power than I give myself credit for, you know, and whether or not that's endowed by someone else is beside the point. But my point is that, yes, a good conception of that helped me to get sober. And then what really is the key, dude, is having goals, is having a plan. You know, I see guys that I got sober with and they made it a few years and they're drunk again. You know, one of my good buddies, the dude that I sold dope with at the house that I got robbed in back in the day. He just called me the other day for the first time in 5 years, and he is off his rocker. He's rambling. He thinks he's Enoch from the Bible, and he thinks that he has the responsibilities of Noah, and he has to build an ark in the next 40 days because the world's ending. Like he is insane. He's gone, and he's never coming back. The dude has fried himself. That's what you're dealing with, and that's why it's so important to, you know, stay sober, man, and to get a goal. Like my goal is success and you know, financial, physical, mental, emotional success. Like I want to win, and that's what I've ingrained myself with, and it's kept me sober and in good health. And and that's the key, is a goal.
That's right. Something to shoot for. How was it once you felt like you really were being honest with yourself and committed to changing and cleaning up? How was it like your first few months? Did it seem like every day you were aching for it, or little by little, gradually, you know, it was becoming a thing of the past and you were just working, like you said, towards something more favorable, towards success, towards goals that you had?
It was tough at first, man. From the time I got out of jail to the bad relationship that I had when I started using again, that was a 5-month window that I was, you know, real confident and sure of myself. But I would think about using because I had a lot of downtime now. Because you're go 24/7 when you're an addict because you're trying to get money to get dope.
Trying to get that dope, yeah.
Yeah, and then get well.
That's a 24-hour job, isn't it?
Oh, dude, it's constant, you know? And so it's something to focus on. And now that gets taken away and it gets replaced with maybe a 9-to-5 or something like that. But what about when you get off of work? Your mind's going, you're like, gosh, what am I doing? Like, where, you know? And so suddenly you have no aim. And so that is what really ratcheted me back towards bad relationships, bad people, and doing bad things, you know? And so I could see that and I had to change my ways, you know? So I picked up exercise, which I've really been hitting a lot recently, but not so much for the past couple of years. But, and then concrete goals, like we're trying to build wealth. And that is it's a tall order from a kid with humble backgrounds and then, you know, felonies and drug charges and whatnot on the record. You know, it's a tall order and it's possible, but it takes work. And that work is what has kept me sober.
And you moved on, like you're doing things on your own terms. Like after you cleaned up and you started to move in that direction where you had goals and you were planning to build wealth and build success and build something that you can be proud of, you know, build your castle or your empire. And now you're running your own show, aren't you?
Yeah. That's how it went. I was fresh out of jail. My dad was there for me when no one else was, you know, and he's always been in my corner. He really has. And on the way back from jail, within 30 minutes of me getting out, he had me a job, you know, at a tree farm. And so I worked on that tree farm for a while, hard work, you know, but I made some money and then moved out of my dad's place. He let me stay there. Got a little apartment and got a better job, right, at a property management company. And we subcontracted for a landscape company. And then I worked my way up through the ranks at that company, ended up being a foreman for them, running, you know, $150,000 landscapes, running the jobs, and had a crew under me.
No prior experience with that? Before that?
Well, no, not with the landscape. I've always been involved in carpentry. Like my dad was a carpenter and I would go on the job site with him. And so I learned how to bang nails, but no, I just picked it up quick. So within 3 years I was running crews for landscaping, you know, and then that was the year that I said, you know what, I can do this myself. And it's really that simple, is you just start an LLC and you print up some, you know, what you do is the door hangers, right? Uh-huh. Physical marketing. Yep. And then I just went out and started hitting subdivisions and I'd pull up in a car, get out and just go up to random houses and clip on my flyer onto their doorknob, you know?
Were you doing it solo bolo in the beginning? Like when you first started out and figured like, I'm gonna go ahead and branch out and do my own thing. Or did you have like a partner or two that were helping you out?
Well, solo for sure. Solo dolo. And I still am. This is my second year. I'm still owner operator, but I'm trying. This is the year where I scale and I at least hire a guy.
Uh-huh.
But I skipped a tiny bit ahead between the time when I was working at that landscape company. I built a tiny house in my free time. So a little tiny guy. Yeah. It was 12x16. Cool little just one, like a studio, barely big enough for a bathroom, a little kitchenette, and a studio, you know, bed area. Super cool though. And
how long did that take you?
Oh, that took about 400 man hours, a couple months after work, you know, like three or 4 months.
That's something that you can just afterwards, you know, you sit back and admire, like, this is all me.
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was tough, dude. The electrical and the plumbing was something that I spent a lot of time YouTubing because I ain't an electrician and I ain't a plumber. But the rest of it, fairly straightforward, you know. But I did every facet of it, like from drywall to installing the tub pan to, you know, vinyl flooring to the paint to the trim to, you know, all of it.
That's impressive, man. That's impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. So I banged that out, sold that, bought an excavator. And then I started the business. So I did leave that part out. I got some tooling, you know.
Yeah. That's putting blood, because nothing comes easy. From nothing comes nothing. I mean, you put the work in, you put the time in, and you leveled up, but you could, you know, you had a million excuses. You could have used this or used that, like why it won't work, why it can't work. And look at me, I'm just a, you know, from the felonies and things like that. Like, this is things that are on my record and I can't get a regular job. Well, if you can't get a regular job, then you just create a job.
Yeah, that's it, dude. And you know what it is quantum physics, really. If you really want to level your life up, quantum physics was the answer for me. And it's there's a good book, Becoming Supernatural by Dr. Joe Dipinenza.
He's bad. Yeah. Yeah. No, wait. Yeah, Joe, is it Joe Dipa or Joe Dispenza?
Yeah. That might be it. That might be it.
Mm-hmm. He does a lot of like neuroscience, a lot of neuroscience talk too, right?
Yeah. Yep. And that book really helped me. Obviously, like Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill, U Squared, Price Pritchard. There's some good books like that. Really just the power of your mind, right? Yeah, that's how I built my business, was just feeling grateful for things that I don't have yet is really the key. And it's that emotional charge that creates all things, like, you know, and that's where you really get deep into philosophy. So we don't have to really go too far in the weeds, but it's helped me a lot. I banged that tiny house out, sold it, bought an excavator. I was hauling it, man, in this little lawnmower trailer that I ended up breaking in half because of the weight of the excavator. It was made for a lawnmower. I had an excavator in there in the back of an F-150. Oh, I snapped the whole trailer in half. I jacked it up, welded it together. Like struggle bus type stuff, right. You know. But I made some money and I was able to buy a bigger truck, bigger trailer, and get more clients, you know. And so this year is really just continuing that arc, you know, and really trying to hit some better numbers, you know.
Right. How has the client base been? Have you had regulars, or it's still, you know, it's still in that growing stage?
I mean, I have a couple regulars. It's more, I don't do maintenance. I do new installs and light excavation and stuff like that. So it's more bigger projects. So they're usually one-offs, but they're large enough where I don't need that many of them. And my overhead is so low because it's not like I have a payment on the excavator. It's cash. The truck is cash. The trailer is cash. I literally pay $100 a month in insurance. I have $1 million policy and that's it. You know, so I can't go bankrupt because there is no bank to rupt. Like there's no way that it can be taken. That's it. So it can't fail. Therefore, you know, like even if I got one job a month for a day, I could pay my expenses because my apartment's $500 a month. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah, like, perfect. You're living within your means. Everything is, yeah. The formula for success right there, especially with a low overhead.
That's the thing, though, is that that's not as scalable as it could be. If I went and got a loan and got more equipment, I might be able to get bigger jobs and do it faster. You know, so it's a balance. It's a balance there. And I don't want to play it too safe, but that's what I'm playing with right now, is that line of risk and reward, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the key for 2024, is to figure out where that is.
To find that right line out, because then also at the same time, say you push it too far and then you realize, like, I put too much on my plate and it's going to break.
That's the thing. There's a triangle of leads, capital, and manpower, and they all work together. You know what I mean? Like, if you have the lead, now you get the capital, but you need the manpower for the leads. You know, or you have the capital, but you need the leads because you have money and equipment, but no leads, you know, so it all works together. And how you can't scale just one, you got to scale three. And so it boils down to being cautious, because a lot of new businesses fail for the very reason you're talking about. They take on too much.
Mm-hmm. They try to get too big too soon.
Yep. So that's what it is, man. And it's super exciting. Here in a couple months, I'll hit 5 years sobriety. I gave up nicotine on Thanksgiving. I was using the Zen pouches. And
yeah, I've heard of those.
Yeah. Kind of like Velo. You guys got Velo across the pond there, you know. But it's a bad thing. It was messing with my circulation. And I was just like, you know what? I'm quitting it. And it ain't that hard. It sucks, but you can just stop using it.
So. Yeah, because there's some people that have used, still using. Sometimes we tend to substitute one thing for another.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's what you got to do. There is a void in your life, but you got to fill it with healthy things. You got to fill it,
right.
You know? And so it's not chasing women, because you could do that your whole life. And that might be nice, but you're not making something happen. You know, a lot of guys will get stuck in that where there's just, you know, that's their main goal is let's get laid. And that's cool, mm-hmm. but that ain't a good strategy for long-term success. So I've been recently, I've just been solo dolo type thing where it's, you know, I have a laser focus on success and a certain dollar amount I'm trying to hit. I'm trying to hit six figures this year, which isn't a lot for a lot of people, but for me, it's huge because of the time that I wasted in my life. You know, a lot of people did college for that 4 years. I was a drug addict for that 4 years. Yeah. I'm trying to level up on my own terms, you know, in my own way. And so for me, six figures is huge. And that's the goal this year is to break through that number. And then I'll really be happy with what's going on. You know,
I think you're on the path right there. You're fast tracking in a lot of ways. I mean, even though you said, you know, that's some years wasted, but man, turned it around. And I respect that you really highlighted and talked about the fact of not being powerless and then taking matters into your own hand and just, you know, biting on your mouthpiece and grinding it out. Because sometimes you hear about these overnight successes, but I mean, they're not overnight successes because they're not really talking too much about everything that was going on behind the scenes when the cameras weren't rolling. So there's a lot of work that goes behind it. How have you been able to just keep on that clear path?
When I set goals, I never think about them again. This is where a lot of people make the mistake. Yeah, they set a goal and they think about it all the time. They're like, oh gosh, today I reminded myself that I don't have this thing that I want. And gosh, it'd be nice if I could get it. And how can I do it? And they do that every day and it doesn't work. So what works for me is you set that goal, you forget about that goal. And then you focus on yourself. Because right now, if you have a goal, you haven't got it yet. And why is that? It's because, in my opinion, you are incapable of achieving that goal. You are not the right version of yourself to achieve that goal. And if you were, you would have already had it. And the fact that you don't means that you are incapable in your current state of being to achieve that goal. And now you need to understand what version of you would easily achieve that goal. What version of you could crush that easily? You know, and then you attribute that identity to yourself. So you basically, it's an ego death, like a Jungian type of an outlook. And you say, look, man, every part of me and my psyche that doesn't agree with the goal that I have, it will now be destroyed. And you got to destroy those parts of your personality and burn them and watch them disintegrate and float away from you in your mind, you know? And then you replace that with like the strength and persistence and every attribute that you decide is part of the version of yourself that easily achieves that. And then that goal is achieved.
That's a hell of a way to put it. That's some real good advice right there. That's a good outlook. I subscribe to that right there. You know, you hear people, they say you can't help somebody if they don't want to help themselves. How do you feel about that? Like say somebody who's struggling with addiction and do you think that it really comes down to when they're fed up with their situation or sometimes you can kind of push or nudge somebody to look at themselves and start making some changes and clean their act up a little bit?
I struggle with that question more often than you might think. You know, I have a good buddy that I came up with in that landscaping business that I was a foreman for, my protege. He just went back out after 3 years and he's a bad alcoholic and he's drunk as shit every day. And then the guy that I was talking about that thinks he's Enoch, like those two guys in my life, very important to me. And if I had a good way of impressing upon them the significance of sobriety and how it's important to change your life and, you know, what mistakes they're making, if I could articulate that in a way that they understood, I would be elated. I'd be so happy. And it's also obviously a large multi-billion dollar business, probably in the US anyway, rehabs, you know. So how to do that effectively, if you can figure that out, you're the guy. It may be a case by case basis to some extent. Like you say, they have to want it, but how can you compel someone to want it? is a great question that I wish I had the answer to. I don't. I've tried tough love. I've tried being kind and considerate. I've tried, you know, hitting them with facts. I've tried so many things, as I'm sure many people have. And, you know, it feels like I'm beating my head against a wall. And how do you help these people help themselves? I mean, it's a tough thing. That's one of life's persistence questions that I have not unlocked yet, because I couldn't tell you. I tried my best, and it seems like it's up to them, for, you know, for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm. It seems like that's really what it comes down to, is when that individual is ready. You can plant seeds, I guess. You know, there's things that you can do along the way, but until they're ready to receive it and act, it's really going to continue the way, you know, they dictate their life to go. So
yeah. And what I think part of it is people are scared of failure, you know, and that's one of the freeing things about absolutely destroying your life and being, you know, broke and homeless and jobless and, you know, I have nothing, no net worth, negative net worth, is that you've already failed so hard that there's really no way that you could do any worse. And so now you can just go for it, because, you know, there'll be setbacks, but regardless of where you land, you're going to be better than you were. And a lot of people get scared of that and say, gosh, I'm not going to do anything extreme because I don't want to fail. I don't want to have people see me fail. You know, that's a Theodore Roosevelt quote. And I can't think of the whole thing, but basically it's better to, what is it? It's something about, it is better to dare, you know, great and grandiose things, even though checkered with failure, than to like relinquish yourself to the gray twilight that is, you know, the fear of failure is such a strong thing, and it'll keep people locked in a job they don't like or what have you, because they think that they have to know for sure. I know that that paycheck is going to be $1,000 and I know my bills are 600 or whatever, you know, but being able to dive off the deep end and say, yeah, you know, this looks like it'll work. Let's go for it. Let's do it. That's where real growth and success are made, because, you know, you don't know, man, I might make no money. I might lose money. I might make 10 grand in a day. Like, it's however, wherever, whenever, but it's exciting. And I would much rather do that. And so how do you impress that upon someone? Well, that's the tough part. You know, it doesn't matter if you came from money. It doesn't matter if you came from nothing. Like, what you imagine you can do, you can do. And I know it sounds corny, but that is legitimately accurate. And so you just need to understand that and to wholeheartedly believe it, and anything is possible. I mean, you know, kicking drugs and alcohol is just the first step. Then you get to the question of, why did you kick drugs and alcohol? Why didn't you just keep doing it? Well, because I want this, this, and this. And okay, good. Now become that person. You know what I mean? So you got to find that reason. And if you don't find it and you just see life as a, you know, a bleak landscape of suffering and horribleness, and you get stuck in that, you know, oh, everything's too expensive and I'll never be able to afford a house and, you know, the economy sucks and blah, blah, blah. None of those things are necessarily untrue. The economy does suck sometimes or whatever, but find the positives in it. Like, you didn't build the game, but you're here. So you got to play the game.
Absolutely. Peter, that was a good ride, man. You know, I was looking forward to it. So I'm always grateful. I'm honored, and I'm respectful of anybody that comes on to share their piece, because that takes a lot in itself. And I thank you for taking time out of your day. If there's any, you know, final thoughts or something as we wind this thing down that you'd like to share.
Hopefully that it can help someone, or either directly or indirectly. And, you know, I don't look at homeless people the same anymore as what I used to. It's just, you know, that a string of bad decisions in a row that can lead you anywhere, you know, just a few bad decisions from this point in time, and I could be back there, you know, not many decisions away from absolute destruction. So I think social media in today's age kind of paints a picture of life in a specific way. And a lot of people just don't measure up to that, and it makes them feel bad about themselves. So don't let that happen to you. There's plenty of people way worse off than you could ever dream. And you just got to focus on what you want. And if you don't know what you want, you got to figure it out, or else you're not going anywhere. You have to know what you want, focus on that, and do it, man. So yeah, I'm super grateful to be here with you, Richard. Awesome. Yes, thank sir. You for inviting me on the podcast, man. Super cool. I'm going to have to check out the rest of your stuff because I like what you're doing here. It's good for all people, you know, and everyone knows someone in addiction or has had an addiction problem. It's very prevalent. And to be able to understand that better and to understand, you know, how that all works is super important. So props for doing what you're doing. That's super cool, man.
All the best.
Yes, sir.
Peter's playing to win these days, as he should. The man's flipped a switch. He's made his mistakes, destroyed relationships, and almost destroyed himself completely while in the clutches of addiction. But he's bounced back. He became accountable, worked on himself, and is enjoying sobriety plus paved his own way. He created a business. He's providing a service and adding value to the job market, building his empire brick by brick. He's made no excuses, and I love the way he put it. Getting sober is only the beginning. The question becomes, what do you plan on doing now that you are sober? What comes next? He's answered that question in real time with where his time, his energy, and his efforts are being directed. Scaling his business and leveling up times two. And Peter, keep at it. You've got all the tools to hit your mark. You are another giant amongst us. And to everybody tuned in, thank you as always. Wherever you're listening from, let me know where you're listening from. Let me know how you're listening to it. We look forward to connecting with more of you. You can find us at giantsamongstus.com. Past guests will be there, their information, links with their projects, where you can find them, where you can reach out to them and leave them some warm words. You can check out YouTube. I started to piece together small audio clips of some of the past guests that have shared their stories, and I'm going to continue to do that and twine that into Giants Amongst Us and the podcast in general. You guys, it's been a blast. It's been a learning experience for me. I hope you're getting something out of it. If you are getting something out of it, if you are finding value in it, please share with your neighbor. Mention it to your circle, your people around you. Let's keep this thing moving. Let's keep this thing grooving as we navigate life the best we know how. So shoot us a line if you'd like to say hi, share your thoughts and your feedback in the comments section, by reaching out to us, by leaving a review or a rating, good or bad, it's all good. We're going to catch up and do this again real soon. You all be safe, be sane, be free. And as the lights go dim and it's just about time to wind this one down, if you would like to be a part of the show and share your story, or even a story of someone in your life that has impacted you in a positive way, you could always reach out to me via email. I'd be happy to connect. Until next time, and very soon, peace. Do-do-wop, do-wop, do-wop, do-do-do-wop, do-wop. Looking for a sign to know I'm on the right road. Ain't seen no signs since Jericho.